In 1981, after 15 years in the music industry, Rick Springfield became an overnight pop culture icon with that hit, Jessie's Girl. So begins the film that is called Rick Springfield Orchestrating My Life, where he performs with the Santa Monica School Orchestra. And also out right now is Rick's novel on Audible, which is set during a plague, would you believe? It's called World on Fire, and it comes out as it's the 40th anniversary this year of his most popular album, Working Class Dog. And Rick, phoning in from LA, California. Hello.
Hello, hello. How are you?
I'm good. Are you pleased to be back in Australia, at least via technology?
Oh, as I get older, it's very weird. I've been looking at houses out there and thinking that I'd really love to move back. Unfortunately, you know, my life has kind of formed itself here with my kids and my wife, but I know a lot of friends who've moved back to where they were from originally in America, so I've definitely been feeling the pull.
Have you? Yeah, we all kind of, you know, we all want to go home one day, return to where we came from, don't we?
Exactly.
Well,
I'm collecting all the old footy cards I used to have when I was a kid and looking at houses. I looked at my uncle's house in Balgala up in Sydney. And I'm waiting for that to come on the market.
Oh, you should buy it and come back. What was your first house in Sydney? Where did you live?
Well, I was born in Sydney, in Guildford, actually. But then we moved to Melbourne when I was about three. So my mum bought her parents' house on Venus Street in Sydney. I don't even know if there's even a Venus Street left anymore, but she bought it. And then my dad got posted in the army back down to Melbourne. So she was kind of heartbroken because of that.
So what, do you have good memories of Australia? I know, you know, you weren't that young when you left. Your formative years were spent here, which, you know, that's where you became a musician.
Yeah, absolutely. I moved to England. We moved to England when I was nine. My dad was, like I said, in the army. So we shipped around a lot. We moved to England. And I discovered Cliff Richard and the Shadows over there and then came back to Oz, and all my, you know, it was all my playing and learning to write songs was all in Australia.
Did you have music in your family? Were your dad or mum into music?
Yeah, that very much so. My dad was a singer, but he was a lifer in the Australian Army. But he was, you know, he just wanted to sing to entertain the troops and entertain his mates and sing in church. And he had no real desire to do anything more with it. But I found out actually after he died, my mom said that her big dream was to tour America with her dad, with her husband as a singer. So I guess I subconsciously picked up that gauntlet, you know.
To fulfill their dreams.
Mm.
Yeah. So we asked people about the tracks of their life for this segment, Music Teacher, and one of the songs you've chosen from your childhood is Bobby Darin, Dream Lover. What do you remember about this? When did this come into your life?
I remember living in Broadmeadows. I was about seven or eight. And it was the first time I remember hearing a really sweet pop song. It's the old, you know, D to B minor to G to A, the old standby chord progression that has been, you know, the standard for rock songs since forever. And I remember getting off the school bus and hearing this song, and it really hit me. I still see where I was getting off the bus next to the entrance to the school, to Faulkner State School. And there was a little milk bar beside the school, and I could still see it all. I remember hearing this song and thinking, that sounds like magic.
Does it take you back to Sydney when you're a young man hearing that? You're a young boy, really.
Yeah, they were actually the guitar chords for Jessie's Girl I was listening to it going. It's the same chords.
Same chords.
Yeah.
Same chords.
I mean, not necessarily in the exact order, but it's exactly the same, you know, approach and progression that I used in Jessie's Girl.
Oh, my gosh. Why are they such the ruling chords? What is it about those chords that are just so brilliant?
I don't know, but you can list every hit record, and even up to now, they're still doing the same progression, the same four chords. It's crazy. I mean, you get into some of the heavy metal stuff, and it starts to get a bit different, but those chords are the same chords the Beatles used, the same chords Cliff Richard used, the same chords Taylor Swift's used. Most of, and they just run through everything.
Right.
They call it the magic chord progression.
So what is it again?
Well, if you're in the key of C, it's C, A minor, F to G. Mm-hmm. And everything through the 50s was that chord progression.
Right. And were they the first chords you learnt on guitar?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I learned G, E minor, C, D, which is another key, but it's the same progression. Yeah, it's the magic progression. I remember a story from Paul McCartney saying that Linda came to him one day and said, I found this amazing chord progression, C, A minor, F, and G. And Paul said, yeah, we've been using that since, you know, Buddy Holly, you know, came up with it.
Right. So how old were you when you started learning guitar as a young bloke in Australia?
I was 13 when I got my first guitar. My mum bought it for me. And I actually said, I want a guitar. And then I changed my mind about 2 weeks before Christmas, said, no, my birthday, and said, I want a robot. And she said, oh, really? So she'd either already bought the guitar or she was disappointed that I wanted a robot instead of the guitar. So I said, no, I'll take the guitar. So.
Well, aren't we glad you did? History would have been changed if you got that robot.
Oh, I might have been like a software genius.
Maybe it would have been, but a whole lot of music wouldn't be made in the world.
Spared the world a few pop songs.
Quite a few. And I don't think we can be spared them because there's just so many of them we love so much. And that was the great thing. I know you didn't finish high school. Were you in the school band or a school orchestra at school?
No, we didn't have one. Our music program was basically memorizing when Mozart was born, and my school career was tormenting. It was like you had to memorize all these crazy dates. It had no, you know, music was not about memorizing when they were born or anything. It's about the love of music, and it was nothing to do with that. I discovered music outside of school, absolutely, with my friend John Kennedy, who I'm still friends with, and in Australia, we started a band together, and it had nothing to do with school. I mean, it was really, I got kicked out of school when we hit algebra, and I said, I don't know, you know, how do two letters add up to a number? I had absolutely no idea.
But they kicked you out of school because you couldn't do algebra?
I kicked myself out of school because I stayed away for, you know, I mean, my last year at school, I was away for 3 months of the year. So they said, you know, you're out of here.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Paul McCartney, and you've also chosen a Beatles track. So what were the Beatles to you as a young man?
It started with Cliff in the Shadows, you know, the red guitar, the red Fender Strat. But once the Beatles came on the scene, I saw them in Festival Hall in 1964. And it was a life-changing experience. I mean, back then, Australia, you know, we had Johnny Devlin and Johnny Chester, and the Phantoms opened for the Beatles, and we were still locked into the bouffant hair and the leather and the 50s rock and roll. And then suddenly the Beatles arrived on stage, and they looked like Martians. They had Cuban heel boots and relatively long hair and these amazing instruments. And then they opened their mouths and started to sing. It was like, oh, wow. It was a life-changing moment. I still have my program from that show too.
Do you? Gosh. And sadly, Festival Hall's no longer, but they have a tribute to all
no,
the artists.
They knocked it down?
They knocked it down, and it's now these tacky apartments. But in the foyer, they have some of the old chairs made into an artwork and all the people that played there, including the Beatles.
The bastards.
So did the Beatles make you want to be the rock star you became?
They started me getting really interested in writing. You know, we all said, oh, if they can do it, I can do it.
Mm, yeah.
Not realizing that they were about to write, you know, the 150 best pop songs of all time. But yeah, it was definitely that was the main motivation for me to start writing music. Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something.
I think you'll understand. Are those the basic chords as well, Rick?
Yeah, it's the same chords. They threw in an extra one, but yeah, it's basically the same chord progression. But I was in Sydney, actually, when I first heard that. I was visiting my uncle. We were visiting my uncle up in Sydney, and his house in Balgala. And I remember hearing that, and I couldn't that the high B note that Paul hits in when they say, "I want to hold your hand," that blew my mind. I'd never heard anything like that. That's actually the same time that I first heard myself singing, unfortunately, because my uncle had a new tape recorder. He had a Grundig tape recorder, reel to reel. And I sang. We're all gathered in his living room in Balgala, and I sang Just Like Eddie, which was a song by Hines at the time, and I sang that. And hearing my little squeaky voice back, I mean, I'm surprised I didn't just say, you know what, this is not going to work.
Well, it must have been, you know, it was early days, right? Like, did you ever have voice training, or you just?
Nah.
Yeah.
No. I never really thought I was much of a singer. I was more interested in the guitar, so that was kind of what I focused on. I only really started singing because I wanted people to hear the songs I was writing. Mm. I mean, I was very happy to write songs for Zoot. But once we split up, I was getting ready to join another band or form a band or something. And then Mitch O'Driscoll from Go-Set, who was a big champion of mine in the early days, said, you have to go solo. I'd never really thought of it before. And so I just started, you know, pursuing that path because she said it was a good idea.
And it sure was. I just want to go back to the Beatles for a moment before we get to Zoot and then moving to America and your life, because you mentioned Festival Hall and the gig that you went to when you were young and how it just blew your mind. That was the best gig or the most memorable gig you've ever been to?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I've seen great bands, but it was the Beatles, you know. I mean, I remember them walking on stage. I was like 14 and I just started screaming like a girl.
You
I
were
mean,
screaming.
I couldn't stop it. I kept thinking, oh my God, I'm screaming. Why can't I stop screaming? I'm like, ah! It was crazy.
Why were you screaming? Just the hysteria of them.
Oh,
actually
just the energy
being in front
in the
of
room.
You. Yeah.
Yeah, the energy in the room was amazing. And actually, Pete Watson, who was in the Phantoms at the time, was opening for them. And Pete Watson was the guy that got me into playing professionally. I was after I got kicked out of school, I was, I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was supposed to go back and go to a private school because they wouldn't take me at the public schools anymore after I'd stayed away for 3 months of the year. And I'm in my bedroom. My mom walks in and said, Pete Watson's in the living room, wants to talk to you. And Pete was a big star back then. I mean, he MPD and Pete Watson's Rock House. And I thought she was kidding. And I walked out and Pete's in the living room and he said, oh, I saw you play at a club the other day and I'd like you to join my band. And I went to my parents and said, what should I do? You know, should I go back to school? Because they'd already bought all the books and my uniform and everything. Or should I, you know, I really like to play music. And they said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to play guitar. So that was really... Pete opened up for the Beatles on the Festival Hall show. I didn't know him back then, but yeah.
Yeah. Gosh, your paths crossed again. I just want to play a little bit of it because I want to hear if we can hear you screaming.
That's me.
Is that you? That's you.
Yeah.
That's
the
Rick.
High one.
There you are screaming at Festival Hall.
Yeah. The boy, wow. The boy that sounds like he has no testicles. That's me.
Well, lucky they came down eventually.
Oh my God, I know.
But see, this is the thing. You and then you've had girls screaming at you. So you've experienced the Beatles thing. I mean, that's why they stopped playing live though. They said they couldn't hear themselves over all the screaming.
Yeah, it was that and also the whole thing of in Indonesia where they got, you know, their lives threatened and it was a very scary moment actually. I have a very good friend actually who plays drums with Ringo, Greg Bissonette. And he's got all, you know, Ringo. He's been Ringo's drummer for like 16 years, and he has all the stories. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I suppose so. You know, if that boy, if you told that boy at Festival Hall, there'll be people screaming for you one day. Would you ever have believed it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I never thought anything was impossible, which is probably my greatest gift. Is that I thought I never ruled anything out for myself, and. And I'm very determined, and I think I got that from my mum. My mum was, she was an orphan at 15 during the Depression and had really tough life, but I call it soldiering through. And she was a great inspiration to me.
And yet you also say at some stages in your life you didn't have much confidence as a musician and an actor, even though you were out there having hit singles, you know, top of the charts and on a show that millions of people would watch every day on General Hospital.
Yeah, that was part of my my depression. And I was just a very dark kid. I was failing, like I said, I was failing at school. I was failing at relationships. I was failing at being, I wasn't in the clique at school. So I was everything that I was supposed to be succeeding at. And when I was 15, 16, I was not. And I was very depressed about that. And but in the end, music saved me, which is the whole point of the orchestrating my life and doing the show with high school kids was music saved me. And I see these, we had 100 kids on stage from age 14 to 18, and they're all a lot of them were very eloquent. And I saw them much, much more focused than a kid that is, that doesn't have a musical focus. And that's why I champion music in schools. You know, I want to get rid of math. Math sucks.
My son would totally agree with you. Oh, loves geez, music, hates maths.
Oh, just kicked me out of high school. Yeah. But music saved my life. So, you know, you're not going to get 100 mathematicians out of a math class, but you could. We had 100 kids on stage that could easily have some kind of career in music.
Yeah. Rick Springfield is with me on ABC Radio. And the documentary he's talking about is called Orchestrating My Life. And your book, which we'll talk about later, World on Fire, is out now. But, of course, your autobiography as well tells your life story, which you also, you touch on moments of it in the film. The autobiography is called Late, Late at Night. You did like creative writing, though, at school, right? And so now you're a writer as well.
Yeah, that was the only thing I got any attention for at school was my essays. And my English teacher, I remember her telling me I should be a writer. Everyone else, you know, all the other teachers were kind of looking at me saying, you didn't do your homework, Richard.
You mentioned Cliff and the Shadows and Hank Marvin, the guitarist for the Shadows, was a big influence. Let's hear him in action. This is the theme from Frightened City. So talk to me about why Hank Marvin from The Shadows was such a big influence on you.
I was living in we were living in England at the time, and the Shadows were it. He was the first European guitar god, and you talk to Eric Clapton, you talk to Jimmy Page and Brian May and Mark Knopfler, they all honor Hank as their inspiration. And he was, you know, he's not known in America, which is a real shame because he was such a brilliant player. But the Frightened City is amazing to me because he digs into the guitar so hard that it was really the first real rock song, I think, that I ever really heard was the Frightened City. You can hear the angst and the desire in their playing. I can still hear that today.
So, Rick, you talk in the film Orchestrating Your Life about being 15 or 16 years old. You're in a blues band in Australia, and they wanted to break your leg when you left.
Yeah, they did, the bastards. I know. I was playing in the blues band, and I was 16, and these guys were all like 23 and 24, and it was a rough crowd. They were from Jordanville, which I don't even know if Jordanville's a rough part of Melbourne anymore, but it was pretty rough back then. And the singer had been in jail, and a couple of the guys that hung out with us had been in prison for different things. And I would never have hung out with these guys other than I loved the blues, and they wanted a guitar player, and I showed up, you know. And I was playing with them, and a pop band came up to me and said, we saw you playing with the blues band. We'd like you to play. You know, we play Cream and Hendrix, and we'd like you to play for us. And we actually, girls show up at our shows because the only people that showed up at blues shows were, you know, 15-year-old boys. So I said, this girl's one of the reasons I picked this thing up, this guitar up. So I said I joined the band, and I went to the blues band, said I'm leaving to join this other band. And they swear to God, they said, if you leave, we'll break your legs. And they, you know, I was terrified. These are guys that would do it. And It was very, I was at the end of a show, my last show with them. They're all giving me hard looks and I'm trying to, get out the door. And this guy grabs me and it's a guy named Tony, who was one of the guys that helped with the gear. And he'd been in prison a couple of times for assault and robbery and stuff. He was really, he was a very hard guy. And he grabbed me and dragged me outside. And I thought, oh, this guy's going to beat the crap out of me. And he says, you go do what you got to do. I'll take care of these guys for you. Make sure they don't hurt you. And it was incredible. I
wonder where they've ended up after all these years.
Yeah, I could have kissed him, but he'd been in prison, a couple of times. I wasn't sure how he'd take it, so I didn't. But,
I'm glad you didn't.
I still remember him. I can still see his face. Mm. He was really a welcome moment when I thought I was going to get the crap beaten out of me.
Well, that was lucky. So as you said, you meet Pete Watson and you joined a group with him, Rock House, and then you toured Vietnam to entertain Australian troops. So was that you said your dad did the same thing. He sang for troops as well.
Yeah, but he was fighting at the time. He was up in New Guinea in the Second World War, and he'd sing for him, in between getting shot at. But we were in Vietnam for 6 months in 1968 and 69, and it was really scary. We played fire bases. We weren't. I thought it was going to be like a USO tour, with protected and everything, but it wasn't. We were flown in by Huey helicopters and dropped off in the middle of nowhere. And we'd be playing and we'd start getting rocketed and mortared. And we got shot at often. And I almost killed the band with a hand grenade. And we finally got home. And Pete sadly passed away about a year later from something he'd picked up over in Vietnam.
Oh, gosh. Right. So it was, kind of an experience really for you that must have had a huge impact on your life, and to also, I suppose, walk in some ways in your dad's footsteps, and then for Pete to lose his life after it.
Yeah, well, it was I was terrified the whole time over there. I thought we were going to be protected, but we weren't. And we slept, we bunked with the GIs and hung out with them, and we even stayed overnight at a beach Marble Mountain. It was a Navy encampment, actually. And we befriended these guys, and it was a pretty small encampment. And we stayed overnight and hung out with them, and we got attacked by the VC. And I'm up in the radio shack throwing mortars down the mortar tube, and with helicopter gets shot down. And
so you actually did fight in Vietnam, really. You weren't just an entertainer.
It was insane. Gosh. I mean, and the next day they came in. We were staying in a villa in Da Nang, and the guys came in and said, you got one. And I said, what are you talking about? They said, one of the mortars I'd thrown down had hit somebody and hit a VC and killed them. And it was freaking mind-blowing. I mean, I still don't know where to put that in my soul. I was playing John Wayne, and at the same time someone was losing their life. I mean, admittedly they were attacking the base, but it was very bizarre. It's still something that I don't really, it feels unreal to talk about it. I don't talk about it very much.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to bring it up, but a lot of people have. But so many people that came back from Vietnam and they couldn't talk about it, right? And they weren't honored in the way that they should have been. So many of the soldiers. So,
I see that over here. They're coming back from the Middle East, and they're just they're messed up. I visited some of them at Bethesda Hospital, actually, some of the guys, and there was a young guy in there who is sitting with his dad, and he'd had. Caught a bullet in the head, and he was like, wasn't really there, but his dad was like saying, he was a great soldier. And it was just so bizarre. It really is.
Yeah. Rick, you were in Zoot, as you said, then you went to the States, you went solo, and I didn't realize.
Don't skip over Zoot. That's my favorite time.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Zoot. Which song do you look back on the most fondly of Zoot?
Oh, we got to play Eleanor Rigby. It was something that, when we first recorded, everyone said, oh, that sounds horrible. There's distortion and feedback. And then because it was very packaged pop at the time. So this was very anti all that. and it was a big hit, and I was very excited about that it you know, got on the radio even.
Yeah. And so what do you remember the first time you played on the radio?
We played it actually at Hoadley's Battle of the Bands. I'd arranged this version of it with the band's help, and we opened up with it, and they radio started playing the live version, and everybody started phoning in saying, "Oh, I'll play that again." So we went and recorded it, and it was basically live. We recorded it live. You can hear all the feedback, and very proud of it, actually.
That's Zoot on ABC Radio Evenings with Eleanor Rigby. Rick Springfield is with me, formerly of Zoot, of course. And after that, he went to the States, the land of promise, to find fame and fortune from Australia. He's joining us tonight from the US. Was it the land of promise and fortune and fame that you always dreamed it would possibly be, Rick?
Yeah. I mean, it certainly ended up that way. But I was very excited to be here. You know, Hollywood was the greatest PR machine in the world. I remember getting in a car and driving down Sunset Boulevard and going, I'm in Hollywood. I couldn't believe it. And I write letters back home just so I could put my address as Hollywood, California. You know, it was a big deal to be over here and then to have a hit over here. I had Speak to the Sky was actually a hit in America. And it was my first single in Australia, and it was a big hit over here.
Speak to the sky whenever things go wrong, and you'll know you're not talking to the air.
It was very exciting, but then things started to go a bit weird with the whole teen thing. I'd never seen teen magazines before. They didn't have them in Australia. It was either music magazine or I wasn't, but over in America there was this whole teen thing, and I kind of got sucked into that, and it took, you know, I was writing songs about you know, divorce, a woman getting divorced, and a guy committing suicide, and they're putting me in all these teen magazines.
Teen Idol, yeah, and they made it, yeah. And you had a cartoon featuring yourself.
Oh, I know, god awful cartoon. It was horrible. I remember meeting with these guys, and some of them had from Disney and had drawn Fantasia, you know, this great Disney cartoon, and other guys were talking about Yellow Submarine and, you know, really advanced stuff. And in the end, after, you know, ABC got through it, it was just another Xerox piece of crap.
It's Rick
and Tommy.
What's Bank Burr?
That's Burbank backwards. Just a bit of humor, folks.
Hello, Rick. Hello, Ptolemy.
Hi, Miss Tickle.
But Quentin Tarantino loved her.
I know. That's probably part of it, why he's so weird.
You can blame you for that.
Yeah.
Your cartoon. And then, you know, I thought it was interesting that you said you were writing songs for $150 a week, was it, when you wrote Jessie's Girl and so many of your other hits for the studio?
Actually, my manager owned Sound City. I don't know if you've seen the Dave Grohl documentary on Sound City, but it's pretty great. And he Nirvana recorded their first album there. And he said, you know, his life is, you know, before Nevermind and after Nevermind. And we all, you know, I recorded in the same board. I recorded Jesse's Girl at the same board. And so he did this whole documentary based around this amazing board in Studio A of Sound City. And, it was, that's really, I would hang out at Sound City. It was just a place to be. It was amazing.
Mm. Well, you know, those four walls, I mean, if they could talk, how much incredible music has been written and performed and recorded at that place?
Yeah, we were, when I recorded Working Class Dog, it was Joe, actually, that was, you asked me that, Joe Gottfried. He said, I'm going to put you on $150 retainer every month so you can not worry about money and just write songs. And it was incredible. And I wrote Working Class Dog while I was on that, you know, he was kind of supporting me, and he was an amazing guy. He really was. And he just, I don't know how this studio sounded so good, because it was an old Vox amplifier storage house, and they didn't really change it much. It was just a big square box, but he got this great board, and it just had an amazing sound, and Tom Petty and Fleetwood Mac and Foreigner and Cheap Trick and so many people, Pat Benatar, so many people recorded there. It was just a magic place.
Mm. And you've actually chosen a Foo Fighters song tonight, and you've performed with them and been on the road with the Foo Fighters. Such a great band and still enduring, still playing today, you know, performing for Joe Biden on inauguration night.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about this song, why you love it.
Well, it was Dave wanted to do, you know, a documentary on this great studio and this board specifically, this Studio A board that was like one of four boards like that in the world. And he ended up buying the board and putting it in his studio. So he wanted the stories of people that recorded on this board. And obviously, you know, Jesse's Girl's one of them. And my other albums, a couple of other albums I did on the Studio A board. And his idea was to do a documentary and just talk about, you know, my life at Sound City. And then he said, well, while we're together, why don't we write a song? And we got together and came up with this song called The Man That Never Was. And then he said, well, why don't we tour while we've got, you know, all these people together? Mm. So we hit the road with you know, Stevie Nicks and Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick and Corey Taylor from Slipknot. And it was really great. It was a lot of fun. The band's amazing. I mean, to play with Foo Fighters, they're a great band. The studio, they're really a killer band live. And it was great to do the record, and also, you know, and to get on the same record as a Paul McCartney song was exciting for me.
Oh, I bet, right? That's the Foo Fighters, The Man That Never Was. Foo Fighters with Rick Springfield from the Sound City tour and documentary. We're talking to Rick Springfield tonight. His documentary kind of his life, where he plays with a wonderful orchestra from the Santa Monica School. But I want to talk about your books as well before we finish off, because mm-hmm. you wrote a novel. My gosh, your mind to write this novel many years ago that you've now done the sequel to, Magnificent Vibration, and then the new one. Just briefly tell people the plot of the first one, because I'm wondering where it came from for you.
Well, I wrote my own autobiography without a ghostwriter. They initially thought that they would, you know, like most rock biographies or autobiographies, you know, you tell the story to a writer and they go away and write the story. And I'd already written 30,000 words, and they had this woman lined up, and I talked to her and read what she wrote. And it was like, I don't know, this could be anybody. Mm. So I sent my 30,000 words to my publisher, and she loved it. She said, you got to write the whole book. So I wrote the whole book, and then she liked my voice and my writing enough to say, you should be writing novels. So I gave it a crack. I mean, that's what I thought I'd do when I was a kid, was be a novel writer.
Yeah.
And I wrote Magnificent Vibration, which came out of my concern for the earth and how we're really at the tipping point. We don't have many years left to really make a decisive move and save our planet. So it came out of that. And it's really, if I can't save it in real life, maybe I can change the ending in fiction. And World on Fire takes over from where Magnificent Vibration left off. And there's this whole pandemic, which I started writing 6 years ago, but ended up writing in the lockdown of a real pandemic.
I know, I can't, like, how strange is that for you, though?
I know, it was really odd. And I got a few things right, too, about the lockdown and about how slow the pickup was to realize that this is a devastating thing.
Yeah.
But mine is very dark humor. My novel's very dark humor, but it has some serious moments, and it involves God and aliens and, you know, an ex-nun and I named the character Bobby Cotton after Daryl Cotton, my good friend from wonderful lead singer from Zoot.
Yeah.
It's a very bizarre novel, but it's you know, it's got heart. Definitely got some heart.
Yeah, you remind me of Tom Roberts. You know, have you read any of his books? Just the wildness of your imagination.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, I've always been a reader. You know, I used to steal books actually when I was a kid, because I'd go into this secondhand bookstore on Bourke Street, and I'd buy one secondhand book and I'd stack 14 under it and walk out. Hopefully they didn't catch me. This is before, you know, before security cameras and everything. And my mom was getting really worried. I had this big cardboard box that I had like 100 books in, and she told me later that she went to my dad and said, "I'm sure Richard's stealing these books."
You're a delinquent. School dropout,
no, I
delinquent.
Wasn't. I love to read. I just couldn't afford them. Yeah. You know,
well, that's the thing. So. If kids are going to steal book, I think it's the one thing they can be forgiven for, right?
Yeah, I wasn't rolling old ladies for crack money.
I'm sure you're still welcome to come back and buy that house in Balgola. The song you wish you'd written, why have you chosen Mike and the Mechanics?
I actually did a show. They had an 80s cruise over here that I, you know, compared. But I played also, played the show. But Mike and Mechanics was on the bill as well. And he's a lovely guy. And I've always been a Genesis fan. But that song, it just, first of all, I wrote a song about the death of my dad called My Father's Chair. Mm. Mm. That has been a really important song to me. Mm. And just the way this In the Living Years was written about how the circle of life, you know, the baby comes along, and it's just incredibly moving to me. And the song is a beautiful song itself. And, you know, there's so many songs I wish I'd written that other people wrote, but it's definitely one of the top ones.
Every generation blames the one before, all of their frustrations come beating on your door.
That's The Living Years on ABC Radio. Mike and the Mechanics, as chosen by my guest tonight, Rick Springfield. It's the song he wishes that he had written, perhaps. But, of course, he's written so many magnificent songs himself. I know that, you know, Jesse's Girl, you say in the film, this is the one that they'll play at my funeral. How do you feel about that song 40 years on, as it's the anniversary of the album?
I'm very, very proud of it. It was a couple of weeks well spent writing that one. You know, like I said, they'll play it at my funeral probably, but they better play it in a minor key.
So it sounds sadder. Yeah.
Yeah, so
course.
It sounds sad. What Nigel Tufnell said, D minor, it's the saddest of all keys.
Yeah. That's right. Exactly. Well, it is. It's a terrific song, and you even did it on General Hospital when you came back.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna. I mean, when I first was on General Hospital, it was tough because you know, I started getting viewed as a kind of a soap opera geek that got lucky with a song, and so I always kept the two separate. But you know, after that kind of went away, and I had, you know, 10 albums out, it was kind of fun to go back, I don't know, like 20 years later and play the song on there, because it was the show was instrumental for sure in helping launch my career.
Yeah, well, I, you know, and you were doing General Hospital, you'd already recorded the song before it got big when you were on the TV show, so there was an incredible overlap. That must have been a very strange time in your life, just an extraordinary kind of cohesion of these two things that you were doing coming to mass adoration and hits around the world, the TV and the music.
Yeah, it was serendipitous. It was nothing you could plan. I mean, everybody thought we planned it, but you don't plan something like that. I mean, when I got the General Hospital gig, they didn't know I was a musician. Yeah. And when I signed with RCA, they didn't know I was an actor. So it just, you know, and then when I'm on the big TV show of the summer, I want to put my dog in the record cover, and the label's going, "No, that's crazy." So I had to convince them that I'd put my dog on the record cover.
Yeah, and it's 40 this year, so you're celebrating that.
Yeah, yep, crazy.
I mean, what's your kind of philosophy of life? You've written extensively, you know, about your sort of inner demons. You've written songs that bring such great joy to people, but also poignancy. The one you were talking about your dad, and the empty chair. It's a really touching and beautiful song. How do you kind of see life in a time, I think, where a lot of people are asking these big questions that you do in your novel as well? We are facing a pandemic. People are separated from each other. You know, it's a time of great stress and concern. What do you kind of like How do you make sense of it? Is it all about, does it all come back to music for you?
No, not really. I mean, music's a very pivotal point, part of my life. But one thing I've gotten back into over the year of the lockdown is meditation. I learned the TM meditation in the late 80s when I was struggling with my depression. I pulled the plug on my career just so I could try and figure out what was going on in my head. But I finally got back into it, and it's been a lifesaver for me. I would certainly recommend, you know, it's not a religious thing. It's a spiritual, you know, path that's open to everybody. And it's really been very helpful for me to show me that, you know, that all the stuff we worry about, it's not going to matter in the end. It just doesn't matter.
Yeah. So through, while the music's incredible, it's also about some silence in your life.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And to be at peace and to have a silent moment is very powerful.
Yeah. Well, the reissue of Orchestrating My Life is coming out, and 40 years from Working Class Dog. May you have a great celebration this year. Let's hope you get to play some big crowded gigs.
Oh my God. I know every musician I know is aching to play, and I know people are aching to that's our church, you know, that's where you commune with other people. And it's a very powerful thing.
As you sing, we need the human touch, right? We need it again.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, let's see. Hopefully we'll get you back in Balgowla when this is all done.
That'd be awesome.
Thanks so much for your time. So great to chat to you.
All the best.